Guess what, Will?
What's that, Mango?
I've been trying to write a promo for our podcast, Part-Time Genius, but even though we've done over 250 episodes, we don't really talk about murders or cults.
I mean, we did just cover the Illuminati of cheese, so I feel like that makes us pretty edgy. We also solve mysteries like how Chinese is your Chinese food and how do dollar stores make money? And then, of course, can you game a dog show?
So what you're saying is everyone should be listening.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA. And I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Call it violence if you like. Such violence is pleasing to the fair. They often wish, through compulsion, to grant what they are delighted to grant. Whatever fair one has been despoiled by the sudden violence of passion, she is delighted at it, and the chief is as good as a godsend. But she, who, when she might have been carried by storm, has escaped untouched, though in her features she should pretend gladness, will really be sorry. Oh, hi. Hello. This is Let's Talk About Myths, baby, and I am that host of yours, she who likes to dive too deep into the nastier, more horrifying parts of the ancient world and classical myth because it's fun, I guess? And horrifying, for sure. After last week's episode, the Pygmalion of it all, and my conversation with Imogen about Ovid's Ars Amatoria, I was a little inspired. See, I've had this book sitting next to my computer for a few months. It was edited by a friend and podcast guest, Avon McMaster and Melanie Raisette Campbell, and it was sent to me by the publisher, and, well, it just feels relevant as fuck, given what I covered last week. And so I decided I'm just not done diving into the psyches of misogynists of the ancient world, both real and fictional. The book, you see, is called Toxic Masculinity in the Ancient World. You can see why Avon knew I would want it. Yeah, so I picked it up and I went in search of Ovid. Gods know he was going to be in there. And he is. The chapter is called Toxic Manhood Acts and the Nice Guy Phenomenon in Ovid by Melissa Martorano. And, well, that is what I am here with today. The chapter is serving as both a source and inspiration. Today we are looking at the instances of Ovid's pickup artistry tips being used by mythological figures, particularly, and so even more relevantly, in Roman depictions of originally Greek myth and characters. So these are Roman poets writing about the ancient Greek mythos. Because for all Greek myths are toxic as shit, I think some of the Roman sources that I've been reading really, like, blow them out of the water. But before we get there, I also have to tell you about another two episodes that are coming this week. That is right. This week we've got bonus content. Speaking of Romans, on Thursday you will hear the episode I recorded with past guest, Dr. Jeremy Swist, about a project that he has been working on for the last year. A translation of the Roman Emperor Julian's work. Sometimes it's called the Symposium, sometimes it's called the Caesars, and which Jeremy has aptly called it, the Symposium of the Caesars. Julian was a late antiquity emperor. He made a brief attempt at returning the empire to its pagan roots after Constantine had instituted Christianity. But he died young. And yes, I do wonder what the world might have looked like if Christianity hadn't taken hold. Would it be better? I mean, the Romans were dark too, so it probably not, but it would be different. Mm-hmm, yeah. Julian, though, was born Greek. He wrote the Symposium theorizing a conversation between dead rulers of Greece and Rome and the gods of Olympus. It's like a discussion about who was the best ruler in the style of a Platonic dialogue, but like everyone's dead or a god. It's fun and weird and features Alexander the Great having like a chit-chat with people who died hundreds of years after he died. So, you know, it's a time. What's really fun, though, is that the translation that Jeremy has done, he has then turned into a full cast recording of the piece itself. It's coming to you on my show. So on Thursday, you will hear Jeremy and I talking about the project, the work itself, the translation, the production and casting process, and a little Julianic history lesson. And on Friday, you will get the full cast recording of this piece. It's so well done. The casting is so fun and interesting, and like the gods are in it and all of these rulers, and the translation is so silly and accessible. You're going to love it. At the end of today's episode, I'm even going to play a little clip from it just to get you pumped for Thursday and Friday's episodes. But first, the instructions of Ovid's horror show of a so-called seduction manual being used in the myths themselves. As you might have gathered, enormous trigger warning here. We're going to be looking at ancient pickup artistry, absurd levels of misogyny, and far too much, like, instructed sexual assault. It's great. I won't get into any, like, wild, violent details, but there's still a lot going down in these sources. Ovid is a fucking enigma. Like, was he a piece of human garbage or a brilliant and empathetic poet? Was he somewhere in between? Was he just, like, a flawed as fuck guy who wrote horrible shit when he was young and then tried to make up for it later? We will probably never know. But it won't stop me from loving to hate him. This is episode 249, but he's such a nice guy. Ovid's Ars Amatoria in Mythological Practice. As Melissa Martirano puts it in her chapter, the narrator of Ovid's Ars Amatoria, presumably Ovid himself, quote, teaches his male readers how to more systematically, effectively, and cynically take on the characteristics and practices of the male protagonists in Augustan-era elegiac poetry, as he likewise lays bare to us the endemic violence against women found in this genre. And with that, I want to make clear what I see in today's episode. This is indicative of Augustan Roman period works, not necessarily the world of ancient Greece and Rome broadly. This is Ovid's time that we're looking at very specifically. That isn't to say that what we know of ancient Greece, typically Athens, was kind to women. Gods know they weren't, but these very specific instructions that Ovid lays out and how they are utilized in the actual mythological stories that I'm going to share today, these sources, these versions of the stories are very specifically Roman, like Imperial Augustan Roman. Also, I'm going to say a lot of shit about men today. So I just want to clarify that this obviously applies mostly to cis straight dudes. But regardless of your gender or sexuality, this episode is a pretty great lesson in how not to behave. Just like as human beings. You all heard about Ovid's Ars Amatoria in my episode with Imogen last Friday. And a couple of years ago, I shared more of it. But like I said, today we are looking specifically at how his tips and tricks are then used in mythological sources from his time. Because it's wild and gross. And Marcherano's article lays out some examples so beautifully that I had to dig them all out and then look at them myself and share them with you. That said, the premise of what I'm doing today is entirely inspired by this chapter. The examples that I'm using were laid out there. I'm just pulling the examples that she included, sharing the sources with you all and breaking them down and looking at them through my words. All to say, enormous credit to this chapter for today's episode. The book is also linked in the episode's description. I think a lot about this idea of nice guys, but I want to make clear what I mean and generally what the concept is in this kind of like feminist framework. Nice guys, as a concept, are not, in fact, nice guys. They're that kind of guy who believes they're nice, and that because of that, they are owed a woman's affections. Here is the good old Urban Dictionary definition, because it is super helpful, and from all the way back in 2013. Nice guy, not to be confused with a nice guy, that is, a male that is nice. When used as a noun instead of an adjective, nice guy refers to people, men or women, who believe basic social expectations are currency for sex. Here's their example. The nice guy says, "I don't understand. I'm a good listener. I help carry their groceries and feed the cat while they're away, and they won't even let me touch them." And the reasonable person, who Urban Dictionary terms a sympathetic ear, says, because as a human being, you should be doing those things in the first place. And oh yeah, nobody has to have sex with you and probably won't want to because it's obvious you think basic decency is sex money. To be clear, you are trying to trick people into thinking your niceness is generosity when they can clearly see your transactional intent. It's gross. Stop acting like a nice guy. See, if a guy, or rather any human being, is legitimately nice, then they don't need to weaponize it. They don't need to remind people that they are nice, because niceness isn't something you should have to explain. It's something that either comes naturally and is obvious to those around you, or is performed, and thus dangerous. It's a not all men kind of term. Like when I say, men are fucking awful. Real and true, and they don't need to say it out loud, nice guys, will hear that and inherently recognize that so many men out there are fucking awful, and thus it is a reasonable statement and they don't need to be threatened because it doesn't apply to them. Whereas the not all men type of guy will get all ragey and scream, "Not all men," when in fact, by saying that and getting ragey, they are confirming that, yes, they are one of those men. It's a 2,000-year-old concept and it hasn't gone anywhere. So that is the type of nice guy that we are looking at today. The manipulative kind. The type of nice guy who studies how to be so-called nice in order to use it to his advantage, to trick women, or worse, as Ovid will explain, is often necessary to force them. As Marcherano puts it, quote, "The Ars encourages men to simulate the persona of a nice guy who is devoted to the woman he is pursuing, but it is evident that the narrator views this niceness as a pretense, as part of a strategic play, one that barely masks the violent foundations of heteroerotic sex in Rome." Now, I've got lots of Ovid's Ars passages to read, so just know that if my tone gets all weird and, well, Ovidian, and I haven't clarified what I'm reading, then I am reading a passage from the Ars. It's a little more impactful than my constantly reminding you that it's a quote. Keep in mind, I've cut some down from the original, but you can find a link to the whole horror show in the episode's description, as always. So let's dive straight in to the deep end. "You must act the lover, and wounds must be feigned in your words. Hence, let confidence be sought by you by means of any contrivances whatever. Now, be it your part stealthily to captivate her affection by attentions. Just as the shelving bank is encroached on by the flowing stream, be not tired of praising either her face or her hair, her taper fingers, too, and her small foot. The praise of their beauty pleases even the chaste. Their charms are the care and the pleasure of even maidens. Promise, too, without hesitation. Promises attract the fair. Make any gods you please to be witnesses of what you promise. Jupiter from on high smiles at the perjuries of lovers and commands the Aeolian south winds to sweep them away as worthless. Flatter her, Ovid says. Lie if you have to, the gods won't care, but make the woman believe that you think she's beautiful. Nice guys compliment women, whether they believe what they're saying or not, because they know that a happy, flattered woman is more pliable, more influential. Full body shudder. So who in Ovid's mythology uses this tactic? Well, many, I am sure, but the example that we are going with via Martirano's chapter is Apollo with Daphne. Remember, the Ars Amatoria was written long before the Metamorphoses, and by all evidence that I see, and my personal desire and opinion, the Met is far more sympathetic to the victimhood of these women. That said, Martirano seems convinced that he is just actively a piece of shit, which I honestly also respect. It is impossible to say what kind of guy Ovid was with any certainty, but still. This work, it employs Ovid's pickup artistry roots, like, very effectively. You know this story well enough. Apollo is pierced by Cupid's arrow and, quote-unquote, falls in love with the nymph Daphne. She wants nothing to do with him. She's a devotee to Artemis and has no need for a man at all. He chases after her, intent on marrying her, and in doing so, getting to have sex with her. And he calls out. She's running from him fast, and he wants to slow her down. He tells her that he's chasing her out of love. And then this is from the Brooks Moore translation. Apollo calls out to Daphne, quote, "Alas, if you should fall and mar your face, or tear upon the bramble your soft thighs, or should I prove unwilling cause of pain? The wilderness is rough and dangerous, and I beseech you, be more careful. I will follow slowly." Flattery while in pursuit. Like, Apollo is literally chasing after a woman who is running from him and chooses to employ Ovid's tip for getting women. Tell them they're pretty. Tears, too, are of utility. By tears you will move adamant. Make her, if you can, to see your moistened cheeks. If tears shall fail you, for indeed they do not always come in time, touch your eyes with your wet hand. What discreet person would not mingle kisses with tender words? Though she should not grant them, still take them, ungranted. Perhaps she will struggle at first, and will say, "You naughty man!" Still, in her struggling, she will wish to be overcome. Yeah, another of Ovid's tips and tricks for convincing women to let you fuck them is crying and then, like, kissing them. Or rather, like, pretending to cry. Show the girl that you're capable of emotions. Or rather, capable of pretending you have emotions. Nice guys have emotions, after all. So pretend you're crying. Wet your face with water if you have to. And if that doesn't convince her to give you attention, well, that's when you take it. And the example of this trick being used in practice is none other than fucking Tereus in Ovid's Metamorphoses. Tereus, you might remember, was the Thracian king who married an Athenian princess named Procne. But when he visits her family in Athens, he decides he actually wants her sister, Philomela. Tereus is arguably the most horrific and violent man of all classical myth. And his first attempts to get what he wants from Philomela are to fake tears. Again, this is from Ovid's Metamorphoses, the McCarter translation this time. Quote, "Love made him eloquent. When he would press too firmly, he'd say it was Procne's wish. He cried as if she had also ordered this." Or the Brooks Moore translation that I used for the long reading episodes, quote, "His hypocritic eyes were filled with tears, as though they represented his desire." Ugh. This is such a good example of Ovid's instructions. Like, not only is Tereus pretending to cry, like, faking tears, but it is clear that he is doing it intentionally, like, and with malicious intent. That he's faking it in order to get what he wants. That he's playing up his emotions, his love for his wife even, his general niceness. as a means of getting what he wants from Philomela. Of course, in the case of Tereus, all the tears get him is Philomela coming with him. It's later that he has to use more of Ovid's pickup artistry handbook. And it's a far more horrifying recommendation.
Guess what, Mango?
What's that, Will?
So iHeart is giving us a whole minute to promote our podcast, Part-Time Genius.
I know. That's why I spent my whole week composing a haiku for the occasion. It's about my emotional journey in podcasting over the last 7 years, and it's called Earthquake House.
Mango, I'm going to cut you off right there. Why don't we just tell people about our show instead?
Yeah, that's a better idea. So every week on Part-Time Genius, we feed our curiosity by answering the world's most important questions. Things like, when did America start dialing 911? Is William Shatner's best acting work in Esperanto? Also, what happened to Esperanto?
Plus, we cover questions like, how Chinese is your Chinese food? How do dollar stores stay in business? And of course, is there an Illuminati of cheese?
There absolutely is, and we are risking our lives by talking about it. But if you love mind-blowing facts, incredible history, and really bad jokes, make your brains happy and tune in to Part-Time Genius.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone. I'm Mark.
I'm Greg.
I'm Brendan.
And this is a trailer for a new podcast called Get It to Dutch, A Screenwriter's Journey.
It's about screenwriting.
And a journey. The three of us play aspiring screenwriters on a quest to get a hit Hollywood script to famous producer Dutch Huxley.
Well, I would say one of us is aspiring and the other two are sort of struggling.
Which one of us is aspiring?
Well, they're going to have to listen to the podcast.
But I don't know, and I made the podcast.
Well, I made the podcast, and I think you guys were along for the ride.
So each week, we bring in a script, we read it, and then we give each other notes.
And you'll also hear about our adventures navigating the Hollywood system.
The show features amazing guests like Tim Robinson, Lily Sullivan, Weird Al Yankovic, and Rob Hubel.
And like any great blockbuster, it's filled with heartbreak, adventure, suspense, and just a little tasteful nudity.
And some distasteful nudity.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that, guys.
Listen to Get It to Dutch, A Screenwriter's Journey on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry though, he's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Violence, if you like. Such violence is pleasing to the fair. They often wish, through compulsion, to grant what they are delighted to grant. Whatever fair one has been despoiled by the sudden violence of passion, she is delighted at it, and the chief is as good as a godsend. But she, who, when she might have been carried by storm, has escaped untouched, though in her features she should pretend gladness, will really be sorry. Yeah, it's the same lines I read up at the very top of the episode. If your nice guy fake tears don't work, then it's time to turn to violence. Jesus, that is what Ovid is saying here. Like, though he's working to convince the men under his instruction that while it may look and feel like violence, like, actually she wants it. Like, the horror, truly, cannot be understated. Violence is, we all well remember, exactly what Tereus resorts to. I can't even bring myself to revisit that story again, but you can listen to the depraved horror show that it is, either by my reading of book 6 of Metamorphoses, or for the episode I did for past spooky season. That's how horrifying it is. On horrific and traumatic transformations. Instead, we're going to look at this trick being utilized by another poet from Ovid's time. That time of Augustine's so-called morals that seems to easily lend itself to Ovid's pickup artistry. What we're going to look at is from Statius, and features none other than Achilles as the violent perpetrator. But before you worry that I'm going to blow up your love of Achilles and Patroclus, remember that this text is very of its time. This is not really the Achilles of the Iliad. Like, it's the Achilles of at least 600 or 700 years later, an Achilles with Imperial Roman Augustan values. But first, this same Imperial Roman Achilles is named very clearly in the Ars Amatoria itself as an example. What are you doing, descendant of Iacchus? The wool is no task of yours. Do you seek glory by other arts of Pallas? What have you to do with work baskets? Your hand is fitted for holding the shield. Why hold the allotted flax in your right hand by which Hector shall fall? Spurn those spindles enwrapped in the laborious warp. The lance from Pelion is to be brandished by that hand. By chance, in the same chamber, there was a royal maiden. In her own undoing, she found that he was a male. By force, indeed, was she overcome, so we must believe. But still, by force, was she willing to be overcome. Many a time did she say, stay, when now Achilles was hastening to depart. For, the distaff laid aside, he had assumed valiant arms. Where now is this violence? Why, with gentle voice, Didymia, do you detain the perpetrator of your disgrace? As indeed there is shame in first beginning at any time, so it's pleasing to the fair to submit when the other takes the initiative. Yeah, that's just Achilles straight up raping a woman. And anyway, this is the Achilles before the war, when his mother Thetis places him on the island of Scyros, disguised as a girl, in order to keep him from being brought to the war at all. And this is Ovid's pickup artist manual, criticizing Achilles for doing womanly things, for hiding his manhood behind the silly crafts of ladies. He recalls when Achilles was found out, and that's when he raped Didymia. But as Ovid makes very clear here, Didymia wanted it, even if she said she didn't. Yeah. In terms of this part of the story, most of the detail that survives comes from a Roman epic poem called The Achilleid by Statius. He's the guy who wrote the Thebaid that we've talked about a handful of times on the show, but this is all about Achilles. We often hear this bit of the story, like how he was concealed on Scyros as a girl, but we don't often get the reminder that, at least in this Roman work where, you know, this survives in any detail, he's a fucking menace while he's there. If the Roman poet Statius wasn't directly influenced by Ovid's Art of Love, then the concept of sexual violence being a useful means of achieving what a man wants was widespread enough in the Roman world that, you know, he might as well have just lifted it right from Ovid. Achilles, you see, like, he gets bored of pretending that he's a lady when he's, you know, hiding out on Scyros. He gets restless, hiding himself away in the guise of a woman. Women do boring things.
But it's not just the hiding, obviously. Like, it is this womanliness. He's Achilles, and here he is spending years pretending to be a girl. You can almost watch his toxicity grow. And the language is, like, so eerily similar to Ovid's Ars, as Achilles turns to not only wanting Deidamia, but wanting her regardless of whether she wants him back. His tacts, though, are also the scream of... Yeah, get ready. They scream of the friend zone. The type of nice guy who's nice because he wants something, who pretends to be a woman's friend because he assumes it will lead to sex, only to complain about being put in the friend zone when it turns out that she doesn't want him. Dude, it turns out that's just friendship, you piece of shit. Anyway, the type of guy who gets ragey when that happens, that is Statius's Achilles. Because he first tries to seduce Deidamia while he is still disguised as a girl. Seemingly, like, from the moment he arrives, he's, like, at her. And later, when she finds out the truth about him, he keeps going. But even still, like, no matter what he tries, it doesn't work. Because Deidamia is just, like, she just thinks he's her friend. She just thinks they're friends. He's been there for years, like, long enough that she sees him as a brother. Until finally, she realizes what's going on. But by then, it's too late. This is from the Aeschylus. It's a little abridged by me. For when Achilles, rough as he was, stood amid the maiden company and the departure of his mother rid him of his artless bashfulness, straightway, although the whole band gathers round him, he chose her as his comrade and assails with new and winning wiles her unsuspecting innocence. Her he follows and persistently besets. Toward her he ever and again directs his gaze. Now too zealously he clings to her side. Nor does she avoid him. Now he pelts her with light garlands. Now with the baskets that let their burden fall. Now with the thyrsus that harms her not. Or again he shows her the sweet strings of the lyre he knows so well, and the gentle measures and songs of Chiron's teaching, and guides her hand and makes her fingers strike the sounding harp. Now as she sings, he makes a conquest of her lips, and binds her in his embrace, and praises her amid a thousand kisses. She marvels at the deep tones of his voice, how he shuns all her fellows, and pierces her with too attentive gaze, and at all times hangs breathless on her words. And now he prepares to reveal the fraud, but she, like a fickle girl, avoids him, and will not allow him to confess. Even so, beneath his mother Rhea's rule, the young prince of Olympus gave treacherous kisses to his sister. He was still her brother, and she thought no harm, until the reverence of their common blood gave way, and the sister feared a lover's passion. It's just so familiar, don't you think? This long list of all the things that Achilles did for Deidamia before she found out he was a man, when she thought that he was just her sister. Things he thinks are means of seduction, ways to impress her, and things that she thinks are just friendship, because they're friends. He thinks he's convincing her to fuck him. She thinks they're friends. But that kind of nice guy never takes it well when he realizes he's in the so-called friend zone. It's about that time that Achilles starts to question his manhood. Always a good sign. He starts to really resent that he's spending all these years pretending to be a girl when he's Achilles, for fuck's sake. He decides he needs to prove that he's a man. That's when he meets with Deidamia in a sacred grove, tucked out of the way where he can have her all to himself. Here's the Aeschylus again, abridged a little and adjusted just for clarity. He gains by force his desires, and with all his vigor strains her in a real embrace. The whole choir of stars beheld from on high, and the horns of the young moon blushed red. She indeed filled the grove and mountains with her cries. But the train of Bacchus, dispelling slumber's cloud, deemed it the signal for the dance. On every side the familiar shout arises, and Achilles once more brandishes the thyrsus. Yet first with friendly speech he solaces the anxious maid. I am he. Why do you fear? I wouldn't have endured this dress and shameful garb had I not seen you on the seashore. It was for you that I submitted. For you I carried skeins and bore womanly timbrel. Why do you weep? You who are now daughter-in-law of mighty ocean, why do you moan? You who shall bear valiant grandsons to Olympus. Yeah, this passage is basically Achilles raping Deidamia and then asking her why she's upset. Because he's Achilles, and now she's gonna have his baby, so obviously she should be happy about what he did and not upset. Like, obviously. Because this nice guy learned from Ovid. When she wouldn't give it to him, he took what he wanted, and like Ovid says, like, she really wanted it, actually. Like, even if she protested, she wanted it. That's part of it for women, saying no when they really mean yes. Jesus fucking Christ. Like, this is so familiar, I want to scream. How have men and the patriarchy not even evolved, like, a tiny bit over the last 2,000 years? Like, we are still dealing with the same absurdity. If you didn't catch it in the earlier passages, too, like, he seems to have pulled the old boy with crush mentality on Deidamia earlier. Like, he teased and taunted her, you know, because he liked her. I know my horrified sarcasm is, like, probably enough, but I don't even feel like I can keep going without clarifying the horror here. Like, the concept of boys who tease and pull girls' hair, like, having crushes and therefore, like, it's okay and even flattering is horrific. The concept of the friend zone, as it is seen as something that girls put boys into and not just, like, one person believing the other is her friend when he actually just wants to sleep with her, and then it's somehow her doing something bad when she asserts that, like, is fucking horrifying. And the nice guy mentality, the guy who is nice because he wants something, not because he's actually just compassionate or kind, is fucking horrifying. It's timeless, unfortunately, but it's fucking horrifying. And of course, this Deidamia was written by man. This Deidamia exists in the realm of Ovid's Ars Amatoria, his pickup artist handbook. So how does this Deidamia handle Achilles raping her and then asking her why she's is not happy about it? Here's more from the Achilleid. Horror-struck was the princess at such dark happenings, albeit long since she had suspected his good faith, and shuddered at his presence, and his countenance was changed as he made confession. What is she to do? Should she bear the tale of her misfortune to her father, and ruin both herself and her lover, who perchance would suffer untimely death? And still there abode within her breast the love so long deceived. Silent is she in her grief, and dissembles the crime that both now share alike. Her nurse alone she resolves to make a partner in deceit, and she, yielding to the prayers of both, assents. With secret cunning she conceals the rape, and swelling womb, and the burden of the months of ailing, till Lucina, brought round by token the appointed season, her course now fully run, and gave deliverance of her child. Yeah, this Deidamia proves Ovid's theories right. She doesn't have to be mad about it. Actually, like, she can't be mad. She determines that she's now just as complicit in this crime, so she convinces herself and her nurse to hide the rape and the pregnancy, until she finally gives birth to Achilles' only child, by the way. Neoptolemus, who is fucking horrible. Surprise, surprise. Alas, too great is the confidence of any youth in his own good looks. If he awaits for her to be the first to ask him, let the man make the first approaches, let the man use words of entreaty. She will kindly receive his soft entreaties. To gain your wish, ask, she only wishes to be asked. Tell her the cause and the origin of your desires. Jupiter came as a suppliant to the heroines of olden times. No fair one found fault with great Jove. But if you perceive puffed up vanity to be the result of your prayers, desist from your design and withhold your advances. Many desire that which flies from them and hate that which is close at hand. By pressing on less eagerly, remove all weariness of yourself, nor must your hope of enjoyment be always confessed by you as you entreat. Let love make his entrance concealed beneath the name of friendship. By this introduction I have seen the prudish fair deceived. He who was the friend became the lover. Yep, that's just Ovid promoting the origins of the friend zone. If you pretend to be a girl's friend, then she's likely to give in to you as a lover. It's no wonder the modern incel movement has taken hold of this mentality and run with it. Like, if you can blame all your problems on women, it makes continuing to be a piece of human garbage a lot easier. Because reflecting and looking inward to become a decent human being is too difficult for these types of men. If you have to perform at human decency, then the problem is you, not the woman. Like, real, good men want to befriend women because they appreciate their friendship, not because they hope for sex. They're nice guys because it comes naturally, and they're empathetic and caring people, not because they want sex. They recognize that actually words have value, and when a woman says no, she means no, not try harder. They recognize that violence is bad, rage is bad, and no one owes anyone else sex. Wild, I know. Wow, what a fucking episode, am I right? Anyway, I woke up this morning having no idea what I was going to write about for an episode that I had to do today. But here we are, 5,000 words of horror later. Thanks, Ovid. Maybe you were an enormous human toilet. Maybe you were doing something we'll never understand. But either way, you have given me some great and supremely fucked up content. So thanks. Don't do like Ovid says, okay? Like, I mean, if you're listening to me, then I hope that you don't identify with a single fucking thing that I just read. But I still feel like I have to clarify, because wow, like it's just a little too relatable for something that's 2,000 years old, you know? A little too on the nose for so many people of today. It's good times, am I right? Anyway, that was all awful. Like, friend zone doesn't exist. You're either friends or you're fucking not. And you know, no means no. Weird. Anyway, I don't even... You get it. I'm exhausted by my own horrifying words, so let's just listen to a clip from Friday's full cast recording of Julian's Symposium of the Caesars, shall we? Just a little like palate cleanser. Get you excited for what's coming.
The gods agreed to Dionysus' proposal, but the question still remained. What form should the competition take? Hermes suggested the following.
I think each contestant should give a speech, one after the other, and offer an account of their career. Then the gods will vote for the winner.
Apollo didn't think this was such a good idea.
That's not how we gods conduct examinations and make judgments. This should be about what's true, not what's rhetorically persuasive.
Zeus, however, found a way to satisfy both his sons, while also keeping the party going into overtime.
I see no reason we cannot let them deliver speeches. We will time them with a water clock. Then, after that, we will have a question and answer period where we can put their ideas to the test.
Dionysus poured a couple cheap shots.
Don't use a water clock! Trajan or Alexander might think it's full of nectar and chug it all, and there will be none left for the other contestants.
Oh, that was so fun. I can't wait for y'all to hear what Jeremy's put together for, and our conversation about it too. Like, but for now, let's finish off with a 5-star review from one of you amazing people, as always. This one comes from a user called ABDWG1256 in the States. So good. I stumbled upon this podcast a few months ago when trying to expand my Greek myth knowledge, and it has grown to become one of my favorite series. Liv is funny, knowledgeable, and unafraid to point out the ugly tropes of Greek myth, and I just love her. Thank you. Love to hear it. I need more reviews to read coming up, so get on it, wonderful people. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians, better known as the assistant producer. Laura Smith is now the production assistant and audio engineer. Select music in this episode was by Luke Chaos. The podcast is part of the iHeart Podcast Network. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. Thank you all. What a shit show. Well, honestly, wow. Yep, I am Liv, and I love this shit, even when it's fucking horrifying levels of misogyny that have not changed at all or gone away even slightly.
Guess what, Will?
What's that, Mango?
I've been trying to write a promo for our podcast, Part-Time Genius, but even though we've done over 250 episodes, we don't really talk about murders or cults.
I mean, we did just cover the Illuminati of cheese, so I feel like that makes us pretty edgy. We also solve mysteries like how Chinese is your Chinese food and how do dollar stores make money? And then, of course, can you game a dog show?
So what you're saying is everyone should be listening.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy. Yeah. Right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.